Unbranded on CliffCentral.com.
Welcome back to Unbranded. I'm Timothy Maurice, and we're thrilled today to be having a fascinating conversation about how sports impacts a nation's identity. And we're going to look at, from a youth perspective, how youth really need to get involved with sports and how it benefits them both physically, psychologically, community-wise. We are thrilled to have Mr. Theo Garin. He is the Saturday Sports Supplement editor, and schools editor, and we're going to have a really fascinating conversation just looking at sort of the history of sports as well as looking closely at what's happening now as well as what we can think about in the future. We love your contributions. You can call us on 0861-555-189. If you are content just listening, that's cool as well. You can also tweet us at CliffCentral.com, Facebook, Cliff Central, WeChat, as always, Cliff Central. You can tweet me at Timothy Maurice. That's M-A-U-R-I-C-E. You know what? One of the things I love about sports and the potential of sports to be able to impact a nation's identity is that this is something that goes back for many sort of millennia. If you look at sort of the Roman Empire and how the Roman state use sport to sort of distract the nation, to keep crime down. Sport is a fascinating conversation. So, yes, we're going to look at how it can help you build characters, philosophies of teamwork, pride, courage, and fundamentally changes how people see their power and potential. Sport is no joke. People cry in the stands when their team is just struggling, even before they lose. You ever seen someone just like on the edge of their seat about to die? Sports help regulate the seat of the soul. Yes, it is that deep. And after the break, we're going to be chatting to Mr. Theo Garin from The Star. We'll be right back.
Unbranded on CliffCentral.com.
We know champions often by how well their sports teams do. Nations walk around feeling prideful. There's an erect posture in India's cricket community because of their history. What would India be without cricket? What would South Africa and New Zealand be without rugby? What would America be without the New York Yankees and the Los Angeles Lakers? Today we talk sports and a nation and how it impacts a nation's identity. We have the illustrious, longtime editor of the Star Workplace as well as the editor of the Saturday Star School Sports Supplement, Mr. Theo Garin. Welcome to Cliff Central's Unbranded.
Hi, Tim.
It's really good to see you for a lot of reasons. You know, we go way back, and I know you have a real passion for sports. When did you fall in love with sports?
Well, I was always involved in sport my whole life as a player, as a youngster, and then I went into teaching as a young man, and I became involved as a coach and an administrator, and I've always been involved in sport at a sort of organizational coaching level, and then that sort of morphed into a job at The Star originally as a sports reporter.
Oh, wow. So the question is, when did you fall in love with sports? Was there a moment as a child where you were like, you could feel this thing sort of moving through your veins? Was there a moment when you were on a team where you guys won and it just changed your life? Or do you have one of those moments?
I don't think so. I don't think it, you know, with most South Africans, it isn't a conversion type thing. It's more something you're born with and that...
Part of the DNA.
It's part of the DNA and you are just... in a family and in a group of friends in a school or university, etc., where everyone is just mad about sport.
Wow. It's interesting. I was over the weekend, I was, you know, I took for granted. I actually judged this guy. It was a guy from KZN. And I was teasing him about the Pirates and the Chiefs derby, you know, rivalry. And he was like, he doesn't watch it. And he's just not interested in sports that much. And I was really surprised. What percentage of South Africans do you think are into sports?
Well, I think that's an interesting question and perhaps has to do with what we're going to be talking about later when we talk about South Africa as a sporting nation. Because there's two sides to it. There are those who actually play sport and are involved in it and are, you know, physically active in sport, and those who are sports fans. And I fear we're more a nation of sports fans, TV watchers than supporters.
Interesting.
And you mentioned Kaizer Chiefs, Orlando Pirates derby. I mean, that is the only match which can sell out a big stadium in South Africa, and yet we pretend to be a soccer mad nation, and yet the average league game on a Friday night or Saturday afternoon is played in front of a half empty stadium.
Sure.
So we are more television passive watchers of sport than active sports people, I think.
Now, I want to know quickly, just so for the listeners to have a better idea of who you are as a human being. Because this is unbranded, so we want to unpack. Let's unpack Brand Theo. What's your favorite sport, and do you have a favorite sportsman?
Well, I guess my favorite sport would be rugby.
Okay.
And I don't think I have a favorite sportsman. I admire a lot of sportsmen and women, and what I admire about them is more than achievement. It's attitude and ethos and values and the way they present themselves as human beings.
Sure. I'm going to put you on the spot. The greatest rugby player in South African history is, drum roll please,
Nas Botha.
Ah, interesting. I have no idea who that is. I was going to try to play it off and maybe try to Google it quickly, buy some time, but I'm too slow for that. Tell me, who is that?
Well, Nas Botha was played for South Africa in the isolation days and for a few matches once we got back into world rugby. He was a flyer from the Blue Bulls. He was a goal kicker who never missed. He was known as Mr. Drop. He used to kick drop goals at will during matches.
Okay.
A Curry Cup final at Ellis Park 1 year against the then Transvaal side, he kicked three drop goals to win the game for them. But more than that, he was a tactician.
Yes,
he
yes.
was brilliant in the reading of the game, and I think he would have been fantastic in the modern game. Unfortunately, he
sure.
left before that time. He was also a strong advocate for professionalism in the game and did a lot to improve the lot of the players.
One of the things I actually look forward to, believe it or not, and I don't know if it's just some sort of bias towards your work, but I look forward to the Saturday School Supplement when you are covering sports. And you know what I find interesting about that supplement is that, you know, I feel that high school sports and middle school sports help make me as a human being. So I'm fascinated by youth and their participation in sports. What are some of the things you've witnessed and some of the trends and some of the threads that's happening at school level in the sports psychology?
Well, I think the biggest challenge and at the same time probably also the biggest plus factor in school sport is that it's become highly professionalized. There was a time when schools would choose teams and they'd play against their neighbors at various sporting codes throughout the year.
Okay.
As games and particularly rugby and cricket in this country, which are the most popular ones, as they became more professionally organized at higher levels, that has trickled down into the school system now. Which means the standard is much better,
okay.
The preparation of the players, the prevention of injuries, all those important things are a lot better. But at the same time, it's lost some of its soul in that it's become professional, and you're talking about 15, 16, 17-year-old kids who are being almost traded like professional footballers, bursaries, scholarships, poaching of players between schools. All those things have become the major talking points in school sports at the moment.
Okay, and any sort of schools who seem to that we want to give a shout out to, who seem to get it right. They balance this whole thing, and they really sort of, the academic side as well as the sports side, they really are building solid, well-balanced youth.
Well, I think it's interesting that I have found, and it's something which I've stressed over the years, is that there's no such thing, in my view, as a sporting school that is only good at sport. So there was a time when people would say that School X was a great rugby school, but the boys were a bunch of cretins who used to fail year after year, and that's why they had a strong rugby side. I think the top schools are good at everything they do. And it comes down to leadership, it comes down to management of resources, and to ethos. So if you take a school in Johannesburg like St. Mary's in Waverley, who is the top hockey school in town, top water polo school in town, tennis, squash, just about every code, they are tops. They are also the top academic school in town. They have probably the best community outreach program. Their cultural programs are fantastic, etc., etc. So there are a lot of schools like that. You know, that if you take the top sporting schools in various codes, you'll invariably find that they're good at all the other things they do as well.
Oh, really? So those links are tight.
I mean, you take a great college in Bloemfontein is known as the top rugby school in the country over the years, produced the most Springboks, etc., etc. But Grey College has the best academic results in Bloemfontein.
Wow.
It has a full orchestra, symphonic orchestra in the school. It has the top soccer, funny enough, football team in the area. Their cricket is always strong. They are good at everything, and they have a great cultural program, a choir, orchestra, as I've said, and they do their community outreach.
That's fascinating. I know, you know, again, going back to my own personal history, you know, I was what they considered a student athlete or an academic sort of student, sports scholar. And one of the things that I remember is that there was this stress that you need to be as good at your academic work as you were at sports, and that was stressed in our school. Do you feel like that's being stressed enough at some of the lower level schools? Have you covered much of sort of the township schooling?
Yeah, you see, probably not, and that's where we come to the real sticky issue of sport, schools, and education in South Africa. Is we have such an uneven system. We have 25 odd thousand schools in the country, of which only 3,000 to 5,000 are functioning properly, and those are the schools that are also the top sporting schools, and the rest of the schools' education is basically dysfunctional in just about all of them, and that includes sport. So there are some organizations, schools, football for example, does the best they can and runs good national sponsored tournaments, and they bring organized soccer to rural areas and township areas where nothing else is going on. But that's about all that goes on. There is no regular practice. You know, if you take a school somewhere around here and you go to Bryanston High School or Northcliff, you'll find that there are three practices and a match every week in the summer and then again in the winter in the various codes. And they have A, B, C, and D teams. They'll cater for everyone who wants to play. That's the model of sport in the schools of the kind I'm talking about, the so-called elite schools.
Sure.
In the other schools, that's not happening. And it's part of our problem. That's, of course, a legacy of the uneven past.
Sure.
A backlog which hasn't been made up yet for whatever reason.
So which comes first, chicken or egg? I mean, you don't have an excellent... I can't imagine having an excellent sports program and then you follow with the academic. Is it that priority placed on the academic and the investment in the school and then the sports?
I think it has to both happen at the same time. And as I said earlier, it comes back down to leadership. It comes to an attitude of whatever we do here, we do properly. We don't tackle any activity unless we give it 100%. We organize it properly. We demand discipline and on and off the field behavior, in and outside the classroom behavior.
Got it.
And we have teachers who have proper relationships with the children that they are in charge of, teaching learning relationships.
So let's be frank. So out of these 2,000, 3,000 schools that really sort of are at that level, you know, the vast majority of the national teams. The national team, both in rugby and all the sports, the athletes are going to come primarily from those schools. And, you know, how do we pump very specific resources and very specific leadership skills? Is this a question for Fikile Mbalula, minister, the honorable minister? Is this a question for him? If he was in the room right now, what would you ask him or what would you suggest?
Well, it's absolutely a question for him. I think him, as the Minister of Sport and Recreation, who have an agreement, have a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Basic Education, that they will run school sport. And they need to, quite frankly, get up and start doing it. Because ever since that's happened, I haven't seen much evidence of the right things being done, in my opinion. That doesn't mean I'm possibly right. But What's happened instead is that people are putting more and more pressure on that 3,000, those 3,000 functioning schools to drive the whole transformation agenda. And it can't happen. It's a numbers game. You're talking about 10% of the youth in those schools.
So you're saying if we put a priority on these other schools and develop them, the transformation agenda would be fairly easy.
Well, that I think that's the only way it can actually happen. I mean, you will get. Funny enough, I was part of a program on one of the television stations, which was aired last night on this very issue, and one of the other participants said, "It's all very well speaking about the exciting emergence of black African cricketers now with Kagiso Rabada, Themba Bavuma, and others, but they're all coming from the same place." They all come from that small handful in this particular case of highly exclusive private schools. And that's not transformation.
I see.
It's great. It's making the Minister of Sport happy.
Sure.
Because he likes seeing black faces in team pictures. And of course, that's important, very important, because they need to be the role models. But you have to, it can never be sustainable unless you're getting those players coming from the vast majority of schools in the country.
So it's become the responsibility of these select few schools to churn out and try to take the few minority blacks they have in their schools and actually refine them enough to sort of dispatch them into these national teams. It's almost become a system, almost like a...
It has become a system, except that they're not really refining them, as you put it. They are finding them in other places. They're going and looking for them. They're scouting for them. The scouting system and the recruitment system in these sorts of schools is incredibly sophisticated. And it begins in the primary school interprovincial weeks when these kids are 12, 13 years old. They're being identified. They're being brought to these top schools on scholarships, very often with assistance and sometimes funded by the provincial sporting bodies. The Golden Lions Rugby Union, for example, will contribute towards or even fully fund a scholarship for a young boy who was found at the primary school's Craven Week at 12, 13 years old, put into King Edward's or War School Monument and on that bursary, and then he'll be groomed to become a future professional player and eventually a Springbok. And that's working. I mean, those players are coming through because they are talented, obviously, and now they're getting the coaching, the systems, the equipment, the good competition, and they're developing. But that's not real transformation,
sure,
is it?
Sure. We're talking how sports impacts a nation's identity. We're looking from grassroots level all the way up to the national team. We're going to talk a little bit more about sort of the history of sports in the country and what we can look forward to and some exciting ideas moving forward. If you're just tuning in, we're speaking to Mr. Theo Garin, editor of the Star Workplace, as well as the Saturday School Sports Supplement. Theo, you know, first of all, you know, one of the things for me that's really fascinating is thinking about what should be expected versus what seems right. So I'll give you an example. If I look around the world and you think about the top sports clubs and the top sports teams around the world, how many top rugby teams are majority black?
Well, in the very top ones, I guess none. I mean, obviously it differs regionally. So in Fiji, you know, you will have, and in Kenya, you will have all black rugby teams. But in the top leagues, in the French league, in the English Premiership, in our local league here, there are a fair representation of black players, but none of them are predominantly black.
Is the goal here, if we had Fakile Balula here, would he say that his goal is to make majority black? Is that part of your experience and what you're hearing on the ground? Is that part of the national mandate, or is it just to have 50-50? What are the specific targets?
Well, I don't think they've put on a specific numeric target at this stage. They're not quotas. They're more goals than quotas. But the general principle, I think, is that all activities in the country should eventually reflect the demographic of the country. And that the demographics of the country, remember, there's only about now less than 10% of the population is white. And so it's clearly
ludicrous that the Springbok cricket rugby team, the Protea cricket team, should be 90%, 80% white. That the Springbok rugby team has had the odd player of colour out on the wing over the years, and that there's no real prospect of that changing radically in the years to come. So the general principle is that it should change totally. But my point is, I come back to what I said earlier, is it's not going to change while you're only looking at that small minority of elite sporting schools to drive it. It can only change if the majority of the population, if that of those 90% players of colour are all given proper access to playing rugby in this particular case, then it's going to start changing.
But that's the question. Do they want to? You know, if you ask me to go, do I want to go play hockey? I'm just going to tell you, I'm just not interested. And I just don't know many black people who are interested, you know, around the world. So, I mean, is it fair? And that's my point. I want to have that hard conversation. Is it fair? And if we go throughout and we did a study throughout this country, well, does the average black kid care about being, and does there, you know, being playing rugby? Is there enough? Is there, are the numbers make sense? Does the system make sense? Etc. Because for me, I think there needs to be a bigger question, because then we get to the question around the nation's identity. You know, rugby's for me, you know, beyond the sort of historical economic advantages and the culture being established in sort of England, etc., and it being largely seen as a white sport, can it evolve into a sport that attracts a majority black when the majority of the countries that play it are largely sort of white sort of countries? I mean, you don't find, you know, Nigeria. Did Nigeria play rugby?
No, not at a high level.
No, and that's my point. So, if
although there will be rugby teams there, and the point is, and the real thread that runs through all of it is England or the British Empire. So you take the Sevens rugby circuit in the world, and you look at the teams that are playing there. What they all have in common, really, or almost all of them have in common, is a British presence.
Okay.
Because the game originated in England, and at the time when the game started taking off was the time of the British Empire. And so New Zealand, South Africa, Australia, even the United States, Kenya, etc., etc., the teams of in the Caribbean were all associated with England in some way. And so to answer your question about South African black kids wanting to play rugby, there are places in South Africa, in the Eastern Cape particularly, well, and in the Southern Cape as well to a certain extent, where rugby is very popular, and it's a historical thing. It's always been very popular. There's been a history of rugby being played at quite a high level in those areas for 100 years.
Sure.
And there it's not that difficult. They happen to be the areas where the schools up country go down to find players because they're available there. But yeah, in South Africa, there isn't a school in Soweto anymore that plays rugby, offers rugby as a school sport.
There's no school.
No,
out of a few million people.
No, there's no. The Lions Rugby Union worked very hard at one stage in developing the game there, in promoting it, trying to get it going, and they did to a certain extent. Then funding ran out and things changed, and it's all died away now. There is no school in Soweto that plays rugby as a school sport.
Oh, wow.
And yet when it comes to the selection of the Golden Lions provincial sides, the quota demands that 50% of the players must be black. And so where are they coming from? They're coming again from those elite schools.
Got it. So the system needs to shift, and I think your point earlier about leadership plays a major, major role. If we go back a bit, I want to spend the next sort of 20 or 25 minutes really looking at sort of both the juxtaposition between the history and the future of South Africa. I mean, South Africa's success and part of the Rainbow Nation sort of is fueled to a large extent by the successes in the sports. People use the history and the success in sports as a powerful symbol to say we can move forward, we can do certain things. Are the successes now that we are experiencing, that you are seeing out there, that give us hope?
Well, they always are. They come up all the time. I think the most recent ones have been the performance of those two youngsters in the cricket team, of Kagiso Rabada and Themba Bavuma, who have been performing so well. They've proved themselves to be world class. And as you quite rightly say, that is an incredible unifying thing. everyone's behind them. It even happened in the last Rugby World Cup where the entire, you know, just following the matches on social media, the entire nation was absolutely livid with the fact that the Springbok coach was not giving the black players on the bench game time for whatever reason he had. So they certainly are unifying factors, and everyone there seems to be a willingness for these people to do well. Everyone wants the black players in the sides to do well, and when they do, then everyone's happy. And I think that's a positive thing. It would be better if people weren't feeling that way anymore, if it was just a natural thing that this is our team, and it doesn't matter who they are, everyone wants the team to do well. But we're perhaps still a way off from there.
And which sport, or let's rank them, the hierarchy of sports in terms of economy, which sports brings the most to South African GDP?
Well, probably football, soccer, because it's the biggest sport, supported the biggest, the most supporters, the best sponsorship, the people's game. Then probably rugby, in terms of an international television audience. Rugby have become very well, especially SANZAR, the Southern Hemisphere, have become well organized in their competitions that they've organized.
Okay.
And then cricket. The rest are very much, you know, Cinderella sports, I'm afraid.
Let's talk about some of these Cinderella sports. I know there's a lot of young girls, for example, who play, what is it called? Without the backboard. It's like basketball, but without the backboard.
Netball.
Netball, yes. Netball, sorry.
It's nothing like basketball.
Yeah.
It's played on a court with a ball.
Sure. But is that sport, is the popularity, does it continue to grow, or?
It is the most popular sport amongst girls in the country. By a long way. Okay. It is a sport that's very popular amongst black girls. Netball is played in the other schools to a large extent. It's very popular. It's in a way easier to play in that it doesn't require terribly much by way of sophisticated equipment and fields, etc. It's played on a tennis court with a hoop, as you say, and not that difficult to organize and very popular.
But is it? I mean, I haven't seen a super sport match of netball. I don't know. Does there
is a televised netball league sponsored, very much a concept developed by the Minister of Sport. He was very much instrumental in getting that whole thing going. It's televised and it has done quite well.
Okay, so we're talking how sports impacts a nation identity with Mr. Theo Garin, editor at the Saturday Sports School Supplement. We're going to go check out a quick song, and we'll be right back with Theo.
Download the Cliff Central app, available now on the Apple App Store and Google Play Store. Unbranded on cliffcentral.com.
Welcome back to Unbranded. I'm Timothy Maurice. My guest in studio today is Mr. Theo Garin, editor at the Saturday Sports Supplement. We played this song, Avishka, and we knew you were going to like it. So, Theo, let's talk a bit more about specifically the issue of really sort of, you know, putting the three most dominant sports at a particular level where there's sort of equal opportunity. So you've got cricket, soccer, and rugby. Getting to this other 90%. So we talked about the 25,000, 26,000 schools there are, and the vast majority of the best players come from the minority schools, or the few schools, the 10% of the schools. The other 90% aren't producing top players, which makes it very difficult to create sort of equality and so forth. Do we need more corporate sponsorship? Do we need more beyond government? How do we help this problem? Is one of the things that I think we need to ask. I mean, if corporates spend a lot of their time and energy investing, I'll give you a good example. I was home over the holidays, and my nephew coaches three basketball teams, and on any given day we would be able to go within 4 kilometers and find a massive sports center. The one sports center that I found was a sports center that had indoors soccer fields, about 15 basketball courts, full-on basketball courts, swimming pools inside, and this was not a wealthy neighborhood. It was actually a normal neighborhood, but it was sponsored by one of the big corporates. Do we need more of these type of centers sponsored by people?
Well, the answer is yes, of course. I think that is an essential part of it. We're in a situation where, and we keep talking about that, those 90% of schools and kids, where they don't have facilities. I mean, the development of a good sportsman depends on three things: on coaching, on facilities, and then on good competition, a regular competition. None of those things are existent in those vast majority of the schools. All three of them are existent in the 10% of schools that are doing well. So the answer is to start somewhere, and you have to start, I believe, in providing the facilities for them to play. The schools don't have them. They do have them in the formerly white areas, because that was the culture, that, and there was the political unevenness of the old days. And you're not going to build them in the schools now at this stage. The backlog, as I said earlier, is too big to catch up in time. So there have to be these community sports centres. The corporate world has to get involved. It has to be funded some way. But the government also has a role to play. The government has the agenda. They have the reach. And I'm talking now about the Department of Sports, provincial departments of sport. They have the outreach. They have the presence in all these areas. They should be running it. And they should be mass participation centres. I think that's where we're falling down. To do well, and again, you come back to those elite schools, they have such good first teams because down at under 14 level, in their first year at school, you're talking about 6 or 8 or 10 teams per age group. And so the numbers are coming through. And you, as you know, the apex of the pyramid only gets higher when the base is wider. And we need to get kids en masse playing sport in these other areas. And then the top players will start coming through. How exactly you do it, I'm not sure, and it's not going to be easy. But it's going to require corporate sponsorship. It's going to require inspired leadership from the sporting authorities.
Let's look ahead to the Olympics. How do you think South Africa is going to do in general? Can you have a prediction? How many gold medals versus silver? Do you have any idea? I know the previous Olympics, South Africa had a few big moments. Does it look promising?
I don't think so, unfortunately. Beyond the usual suspects, we will win a few medals in swimming.
Okay.
And one or two in track and field. But I can't see where any other medals will come from.
And just in terms of the exciting, are there any exciting sports that are starting to sort of brew underneath the three major ones that South Africa has actually seemed to be pretty good at?
If I can get back to the Olympics, I left out the very important one, and that's the seven-a-side rugby team, who are strong contenders, who may win the gold medal.
Okay.
Okay, and that is a new development. It's the first time seven-a-side rugby is at the Olympics.
Oh, is it?
So
oh,
that's
wow.
probably going to be the team sport with the best chance of winning a medal would be sevens.
Okay.
And then we've got, you know, we've got the Chad Leclos and Cameron von, you know, and we've got McQuena, the long jumper, and those guys that may get medals.
So, but are there any sports, like, you know, if you look at, for example, tennis. Is tennis played? It's played in the Olympics, right? Mm-hmm. We've got a few, you know, pretty good stars. What's the really tall guy's name? The South African guy.
Well, he's made himself, I think he's not available to play for South Africa. He's made himself unavailable to represent the country in the Davis Cup. So I presume he will not be available for tennis either, and his name escapes me, but I know you mean.
Yeah, is it because he's...
he's a professional player and doesn't have the time to take off to come all the way back here to play in these sorts of things.
So logistics and time. Okay. So, but in terms of some of the other sports, like some of the other, sports that deal with balance, and, you know, is some of this stuff just simply cultural? I think this is the question I want to get to. The cultural more than genetic. You know, if you look at ballet, for example, it doesn't matter what race or what background you come from, you can be taught from an early age. But, you know, when it comes to genetics, at some stage, do you need to be a certain size to be able to play certain sports? You need to be able to be built a particular way. And I don't want to go too far down that particular area, but I know that certain countries, for example, China has a lot more sort of small, nimble, petite type of people. So they excel, for example, at certain sports. South Africa, you know, has a different, you know, very sort of, you know, diverse demographic with different sort of body builds. Does genetics play a role in this?
Well, obviously they do, but so does, you know, it's all nature nurture debate, and you know, there's never going to be a solution to that, but other than to say that it has to be both. So you take basketball, for example, where you have to be tall. Although I've seen the YouTube video of you playing basketball.
Yeah, yeah. And those are luck shots.
And you're not bad for a short guy.
It's good editing.
But they are, you know, basically, you know, in the American, in Major League Basketball, you cannot be a short there.
No, the majority are very
short,
tall.
The short players, the guys who come across on television as being short, are 6'2", 6'3".
Sure, sure.
And the rest of them are 7 foot.
Yes.
And so basketball is made for tall people. And so is rugby. It's meant for big people. There's very little room for small guys.
Yeah.
And that's just the way it's happened. The tactics have evolved to take into consideration the size of players. And you know, physical strength comes into physical games.
Sure.
But that's from that point of view, it's genetic. But at the same time, people can be taught, and people, a big guy won't be good unless he receives the right training and encouragement and motivation. And so it is both.
You know, I'm. You know, I think one of the things I'm going to put out on Twitter after this particular conversation is I want to ask the minister. I don't know him that well, but one of the things I want to ask the minister, does he believe that South Africa could take a rugby team and win the World Cup that represents the demographics of this country? And if so, by which year does he see that happening? Because for me, that's a fascinating conversation to have. You know, having the national teams represent the demographics and being able to dominate is going to require some deep strategy, some high-level development amongst this 90%. If you had to make a prediction, because South Africa has done things that are miraculous and continues to do miraculous things, if this happens and will happen, let's say it is going to happen, which year could this happen in realistically?
I mean, win the World Cup or be competitive. Because I don't think you can ever say you're going to win the World Cup. I mean, there are just too many imponderables. But the best you can expect is to be competitive there. And I think the answer to that question is absolutely yes. There's no question that there's enough talent. There's enough talent. You know, we did a little exercise last year at the time when the World Cup team was chosen and being so predominantly white. In the office, the guys got together and selected a South African team of all black players. And, you know, out of the Currie Cup and the Super Rugby.
Sure.
And that was a good team. If you play them against the Springbok team, they would have lost. They would have lost. But they would have been competitive.
Oh, wow.
So it's not far away.
So it's coming.
It's not very okay. Far away. But it can only be sustainable. And there are a couple of good stars at the moment.
I mean,
but, you know, will they be there next year? Will they be there in the time for them? You know, to make it sustainable, you have to get that groundswell.
I mean, New Zealand is fascinating because the Maori have their own team. And, you know, they play internally. I mean, there's been a lot of debate in New Zealand about whether or not they should remain, but then there's some really good arguments about why it makes sense and so forth. You know, the Maori have a whole history, though, of playing rugby even before whites arrived. They played a sport that was similar to rugby. A lot of people don't realize that. So it's a really interesting dynamic to have how sort of culture can play a role. I want to shift a bit to look at, you know, sort of the injuries. Is it possible that rugby, for example, is going to evolve to a point where they will start to have to wear more protective gear? The movie Concussion in America has really put on the forefront the issues around, especially forensic pathologist Dr. Benet Amalu, who was played by Will Smith, had discovered this sort of neurological deterioration that is similar to Alzheimer's disease that results from this trauma to the head. You know, has there been studies that looked at what the excessive exposure to those hard hits is doing to the brains of rugby players?
Yeah, there's been a lot of research done, and it's something which they take very seriously, and it's obviously topical at the moment. I think the interesting thing about that whole concussion movie and the new discovery is that people have always associated concussion and with big hits, big blows to the head, and therefore you are concussed. But what they've discovered is that the cumulative effect of small blows to the head over many years can be as damaging. And it comes down to even in soccer, in football, a centre back who headers the ball repeatedly during a match 20, 50 times per game
over his career
studies have shown that those guys are showing brain injury when they are older.
Wow.
And there's the whole association of dementia with repeated head injuries as well, which is now, no one really hasn't been fully understood. The other interesting thing, and as you may have noticed, I've read up quite a lot on this, is that the helmets that the American footballers wear is not helping, because the injury is due to the brain shifting inside the skull. It's not the blow to the head. It's not the physical blow.
Direct contact.
It comes from contact, but it's the acceleration and rapid deceleration of the brain inside the skull. And the helmet is just simply putting another harder skull around your existing skull. So protection, physical protection, is not going to do it. The key is to prevent repeated, constant injury. So it's all about, and that's rugby's mantra, from World Rugby and down to Box Smart, the South African program, the mantra is recognize and remove, which means simply recognize that a player has got a head injury and take him off the field, and don't let him come back until he's ready to play.
Wow. Moving forward, what do you see? Do you see rugby and other sports start to sort of shift? How in the tools and the technology do we need to lean to technology and use a lighter type of balls? Do we need to engage differently? Or do you see the passion and the institution and the culture around these sports continuing as is for many years?
Well, I think the culture and the passion is the thing. I mean, you're not going to go anywhere with technology unless you actually have the motivation and the willingness and the enthusiasm to actually play the game.
Sure.
The technology has vastly increased the standards, the techniques, and made the game better, I suppose, in technically speaking. But at the end of the day, we have to, and that's what we face in this country here, we have to instill the passion and the enthusiasm in the people running the sports in the first place.
Got it.
They've got to make sure that it happens in that vast majority of places where it's not happening. The technology can come in later and make it better, but it's never going to happen unless we get the message.
Sure. The reality is that South Africa is a great nation. South Africa has proven over and over and over again that it can compete with the world, whether it's doing heart transplants, whether it's winning at, with everything stacked against the country, it still wins. And I think South Africa has a bright future with regards to sport in being a powerful symbol to show what the country is made of. Is South Africa perfect? No. Is the sporting community perfect? No. But what we look to is people like yourself who can continue reporting, and you're on the ground, you're at grassroots level to be able to continue to share with us, sharing insights. The Star Supplement school section is important, and I hope they continue to. Can we find it online as well?
No, it's not. There's an iPad version.
Okay.
But it's not on. It's not online in full yet.
So you can get it. You can get it. You can buy it, and you can have your coffee of it on a Saturday morning.
No, you can subscribe to the Saturday Star online and get it.
Exactly. Yeah,
but there's no. You can't get it for free.
Okay.
Online.
All right, Theo. You can follow Theo Garant at Theo, GARUN at Theo Garant. Theo, thank you so much for coming in. We really appreciate you coming all the way from the other side of town. It means a lot. We understand that traffic is hectic, so we appreciate that.
Thanks, Tim.
Up next, we have Rianette Lebowitz with our cyber health feature. Rianette, how are you today?
I'm so glad to be here on time today, Timothy.
Good. Awesome. What do you have for us?
I got stuck in really bad traffic, and it's ironic but also very fit for my cyber health bite today, because I'm talking about the cars of the future. And this morning, I wished I was in one of those cars of the future.
Yeah, propellers or something, like helicopters.
Yes, or okay. Just, yeah, transport, you know, appear in the right place at the right time. But I would love to share with you about statistics and a report that was recently shared by Innovation Group. And I went to the launch of this event early in February, and it's called the Automated Future Now Report. And it was launched on 11 February 2016. And this report investigates and unpacks the global and local trends impacting the automotive industry. Now, in a nutshell, a couple of things that stood out for me is the fact that we need to ask the question, will we need dealerships in the future? Will we need to have a place where we can go to look at all the different cars, or will we shop online like most of us do nowadays? Do we have to have these expensive dealerships where they spend millions a month on keeping it up, etc.? But I would like to give you some background into this report. And Glenn Mollink, he's the Chief Executive Officer for Innovation Group South Africa, pointed out that the South African automotive industry is entering an era of unprecedented change, with cars as we know them now about to change forever. Digital disruption is said to be one of the major automotive trends for the future, and he says the rise of the connected car and the digital savvy customer is of particular interest. The connected customer will change the landscape of the automotive industry moving forward, as we are demanding more interactive services and mobile apps and plug seamlessly into our connected vehicles and so forth. So from a car ownership point of view, this study that they did was actually quite interesting to show that people are not as interested as in the past to own vehicles. They are quite happy to use services like the Ubers and so forth.
Sure.
So going forward, that's something to consider. You know, because when you think of your future, you think, okay, I'm going to buy a house, I'm going to buy a car, but maybe you don't need to buy a car. So that's something that I think for kids, you know, in high school.
Sure. And even me, I mean, I've even thought about getting rid of it. I don't really need a car anymore. I enjoy having my motorbike and being able to call Uber. And in fact, being in a car is almost an inconvenience.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like,
or owning a car is an inconvenience, but like you said, with the expenses and so forth, and being able to sit in the back and do work while someone else drives you.
Yes. I mean, I've heard of many agencies that actually they ask their employees to use an Uber or a taxi service instead of driving by themselves, because if they sit in traffic for 2 hours, that's 2 hours billable time.
Yes.
And exactly. Yeah, so it's really working smartly. On another note, Ricardo Cutsia, he's the managing executive for the automotive department at Innovation Group South Africa, looks at how disruptive trends are forcing the automotive industry to change its focus and reinvent itself to put customers in the foreground. Now, traditionally, they always thought about making the cars bigger, faster, better. Now, it's really about how do you actually answer the needs of your customer. And the customers are asking for connectiveness and to be connected with the brands on a very, very different level. So the question is, what does this mean, the rise of the connected customer? Customers are more tech savvy and through this are demanding greater connectivity in their vehicles and also relying less and less on dealerships to provide advice and suitable vehicles. And there are many awesome apps. One app that impressed me quite a bit was that you can actually book your car's service online. So you don't need to go through the hassle to find, you know, call, etc., etc. And in-car services aimed at providing infotainment, location-based services, and apps providing driver assistance are set to gain popularity in new vehicles. So if you are an app developer, this is a great opportunity. Yes, and space for you to be in. So from a safety net point of view, we just want to remind everybody, while we're looking into the future, let's be safe online, let's be responsible, and consider how we drive on the speed highway of the internet.
Thank you so much, Ren. It's funny, I was saying to Theo when we first arrived that, you know, I really do think technology and apps and so forth will be able to sort of help people reduce the amount of sort of accidents as well, because, you know, there now there's apps and technology that can predict when accidents are going to happen and see things.
Yes.
So very, very important.
Yes.
So thank you so much for a Cyber Health Bite. Theo, thanks thank again you. For coming in. We really appreciate your expertise and the work you're doing in Saturday Star. Thank you so much, guys. We'll be back next week with Unbranded.
Unbranded on CliffCentral.com.